Excellent. All right. So this is a formal hearing on case number PU-22-337, the high density contracted demand response. That sounds exciting.
Dripping.
More exciting than it actually is, but that's good, whoever wrote that. I'm Commissioner Julie Fedorchak. Also joining me are Commissioners Randy Crispin and Sherry Hogan-Huffert. So we have a quorum. I don't have any opening comments. Do you, Randy?
I do not.
Okay. So we'll kick it over to you, Sherry, because this is your portfolio. But we might just first go around the room and everybody can introduce themselves so we have a record of that. And then I'll just make the announcement that this is an informational hearing involving only undisputed facts. If there are any disputed facts, we will close the informal hearing and issue a notice of the hearing. I don't expect that to happen. And you guys will go first. So after we make introductions, we'll just kick it over to you for your presentation. And will you be you, Allison, or Travis?
I will be introducing the presentation.
Perfect. All righty. Victor.
Victor Shook with staff.
Go ahead, around the table.
All right. Larry Oswald, Business Development for Montana Dakota Utilities.
Allison Walden, here representing Montana Dakota Utilities.
Stephanie Bosch with Montana Dakota Utilities.
Darcy Nigam, Montana Dakota Utilities. And Travis Jacobson with Montana Dakota.
Chris Hansen, staff.
Adam Renfant, staff.
And we have a mouse in the corner.
Yeah, go share on behalf of the blockchain.
Okay. All right. So, Sherry, you can take it away. If you have any comments, or you can turn it over to them.
I'll just turn it over to you guys. So we can enjoy the weather. Yeah, that's going to be nice today. Compared to tomorrow.
Before the wind comes up.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Well, thank you, commissioners. Thank you for the invitation here to discuss the case number PU-22-337. As a preliminary issue to today's presentation, it is Montana Dakota's intent to focus the presentation on the tariff filed with the Commission on August 1st, 2022. As will be further explained during the presentation, every customer that will be served pursuant to this tariff will have an independent electric service agreement, which will contain confidential information related to that specific customer. It is Montana Dakota's intention to discuss the tariff and not direct conversation in relation to any customer here today. A short presentation has been prepared to present the tariff to the Commission, and with that, I will turn it over to Steph Bosch.
Good afternoon. As Allison mentioned, we have a brief PowerPoint presentation that will walk through the Rate 45 filing, why we filed it, and then just walk through the tariff. And if at any time anyone has questions, please feel free to ask them at that time. And with that, we will get started. On August 1st, 2022, Montana Dakota submitted an application for authority to establish a new rate schedule in North Dakota, which is High Density Contracted Demand Response Rate 45. And I'll just refer to that as Rate 45 going forward. The filing was made in response to customer inquiries the company has been receiving regarding a new type of service, or a new type of customer, I should say, in our electric service territory, and that is of the blockchain customer. A blockchain customer has a facility that houses high-density or high-performance computer processing technology. They can be housed in a traditional brick-and-mortar store or brick-and-mortar type facility, but what makes them different from our other customers is that they can also be housed in a container type warehouse structure that can quickly or relatively quickly locate anywhere around the globe where there's low-cost energy. So that's different from our other type of customers. And why the affordable energy is important is because they are a super user of energy. They consume a lot. To give you some perspective of the type of customers, a typical rack of servers for normal data centers require 5 to 7 kilowatts of capacity to serve each rack. A blockchain server rack requires 2 to 3 times that, or 15 to 18 kilowatts of capacity. A typical crypto mining 40-foot container typically requires 1 megawatt of power. These customers operate at a continuous consumption, so they typically have a high load factor to them.
And they generally operate 24/7 too, right?
That's my understanding. Yep. So with these customer demographics in mind, the company drafted Rate 45. As part of Rate 45, or to qualify for Rate 45, we put 3 requirements to them. First, it's available to any data center type facility that houses this type of computer processing technology. We didn't want to just limit it to a blockchain or crypto mining facility. It's any data center that meets the size requirements, which is the second requirement. They must have a demand of at least 10,000 kW per month metered at a single delivery point, and have a load factor of 85%. This ensures that only the largest of customers are eligible for service under this tariff. The third qualifier is that the company be able to interrupt a customer's service up to 200 hours annually, or as outlined in the customer's electric service agreement. This provides reliability protection for all customers during system emergencies and the utilization of these loads to meet the peak demand requirements and planning reserve margin requirements within MISO's resource adequacy requirements. I'm going to jump ahead.
Yep. I want to make a note because I don't think that 200 hours was in the application.
It's in the tariff under the availability section of the tariff is the 200.
But that's what the...
It could be up to the 200 or as stated in the electric service agreement.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. So moving on to the general terms and conditions section of the tariff. Each customer that takes service under Rate 45 will enter into an electric service agreement or an ESA. The ESAs, as are specific to each customer, will contain confidential provisions unique to that customer. We will file and ask for approval of each ESA filed under this tariff. The minimum term will be at least 3 years, but not to exceed 5 for that initial term. The ESAs will also identify the interruption requirements, which is something, or which will include the number of hours a customer may be interrupted, as well as the amount of time that customer has to respond to a signal for interruption. It will also identify the demand response requirements, such as those cost responsibilities of interruption equipment, the penalties for non-performance, as well as performance testing requirements. Well, it will identify the firm and interruptible load requirements for that customer, the deposit amount, as well as the cost related to any extension of service to that customer. This ensures that any cost responsibility is borne by the cost causer and that the company's other customers will not bear the cost of any extension should the customer leave, as the company's rate base will remain unchanged as a result of the company's treatment of these extensions.
Stephanie, what's the deposit amount? How do you set that? What does that intended to cover?
For each deposit, we'll identify how we calculate it and that amount within each electric service agreement.
Generally, what would be included in that?
It will follow that customer's billing.
Okay, I'm not following what's included in the, like, what do you use to determine what that deposit needs to be? Is it like the cost of extension? It's like what is included in calculating the deposit?
Yeah, commissioners, for the calculation of the deposit, what we intend to use for each individual customer, and it'll be specific to each individual customer, it'll be based upon what, the size of the load, amount of expected usage, what their billing is, and we'll want to ensure that we have a deposit that will give us the opportunity to have a cure period if they're not, if they're delinquent in paying their utility bills, so that, we can protect customers and the company from, an uncollectible type of an account situation. So it'll be customized for each customer, and we'll spell that out in the ESA.
So it's kind of projected use.
Correct.
In blockchain, so if they were in arrears, you'd have a couple months of projected use to cover in case they don't pay.
Correct.
And fail. Okay. Take their trailer and run.
But, okay. So them potentially skipping out on paying the bills, that's one thing, but your cost to serve them in the first place, I mean, it's got to be substantial, especially if it's a really large one. And then, of course, depending on where it's at. So is the deposit cover some percentage of what it costs you? Because if they skip out, let's say they've paid the bill, or your deposit covers it or whatever, what about the rest of that cost to provide service because you thought they were going to be here for 10 years and they left after 6 months?
Sure. Mr. Crispin, so depending upon the location that they're wanting to take service, we would do a study and estimate of what it's going to take to get an extension to them, and that ends up being a deposit or prepayment they would make in the form of a kayak. So they would be paying for all of those. They would be paying for all those facilities up front to extend that service to them, and so that way there's no risk borne by other customers because they paid for that up front, non-refundable, that it would end up being. So.
What is kayak stand for?
It's a contribution and aid for construction.
Oh, okay.
And that would not be discounted like it would be for other types of customers.
Would not. Correct. It'd be the full amount.
Okay. Because for other customers, we assume a certain level of usage that is going to offset, so they get a reduction
full,
to that.
Full for the extension. So we'd estimate that ahead of time, and then once those facilities are completed, we do a true up with what the actuals were.
Now if we move back to the billing section of the tariff, the rate structure for under rate 45 is different than our traditional rate structure where you see a basic service charge, an energy charge, and a demand charge. Each ESA filed under this tariff would identify what that pricing is, and it will be designed to recover the incremental costs incurred by the company in providing electric service to that customer. So what rate 45 does, it allows a few different things. That one, allows customers or potential customers to see that we do offer such a service, but it also provides the company the ability to offer these customers a lower overall energy cost or bill, as well as help incentivize customers to locate in our service territory. Due to the potential size of these customers' bills, we are proposing that we be allowed to offer an alternative billing frequency other than the traditional 30-day bill that all the other customers receive today.
By alternative, you mean like weekly potentially?
Right, something other than once a month.
More so frequent.
Right. Yep. So moving on to some of the benefits, we see the first one would be the community benefit through employment opportunities as well as additional tax revenue in the communities these customers locate in. But one of the bigger benefits we see is these customers will help lower the overall transmission cost for all customers, as our Rate 45 customers will be charged Montana Dakota's zonal transmission rate. And I think the easiest way to see this is if we look at the next slide. So the top part of this slide shows Montana Dakota's Attachment O revenue requirement for 2022. The bottom half of this slide demonstrates a hypothetical 50-megawatt data center coming on. As you can see, that changes Montana Dakota's overall percentage. It increases that, but Montana Dakota customers will pay less by about $2.1 million. So if you go over to the allocated side of the slide, under today, it would be $25 million. Under this hypothetical example, it would be $22.9 million that MDU customers would pay for transmission under today's rates.
So they'd take like 7% of the allocated total of the, wow.
Right, in this example, it would be the 8%. The middle, the 50,000 under the attachment O divisor. It's 8%, and they would pick up the 2.4 of that, that 30.5 revenue requirement. And that completes the presentation.
Do you have some questions? So, do you have potential customers looking at this rate?
I guess I would just say answering that without providing any confidential customer information on that one.
We have had interest. There's been interest in this type of service.
And we recently filed an electric service agreement with one customer. I don't know, I can't remember the date, but 21st or 22nd
last week.
This month.
Yeah. Go ahead.
How do you determine the interruptible amount?
So the one thing, in order to qualify as a demand response load under MISO's tariff, it's a minimum of 50 hours. So mm-hmm. So we went above and beyond that, the minimum requirement, so there was some additional flexibility that we would have for other events other than what may be called upon to at least meet that minimum requirement of 50 hours.
Okay, so but you've got up to 200 hours, and I'm just curious, when you actually have a customer, how do you determine where you're going to land for how many hours they're going to have to be agree to be interrupted?
So part of that, it's an up to, and the actual will depend upon the actual year. You know, certainly depending if MISO has an event they call upon, it comes up with those hours. You know, typically, you know, the data centers coming in certainly want to have as much uptime as possible. And so it's one of those pieces of looking at, I think, other arrangements that they've made and kind of, I don't want to say what is an industry standard, but what seems to be appropriate. We ended up landing on that 200, but again, that's...
But each ESA could be different. So yep. How do you determine for each ESA, like, we're going to, like, we need to have at least 100 hours on this one, or we need at least 150 for this one. How do you determine that? Like, what system things are you looking at?
So part of that, again, of looking at the amount of conditions we would look for interruptions, taking at that. Certainly an interruption occurs if MISO calls on an emergency event. There's an expectation of interruptions. And then it would be anything beyond that. If there was some sort of economic condition or reliability that was outside of a MISO interruption, we would look to call on this. And so some of our starting points. Do you have something, Larry?
Yeah, Commissioner Fedorchuk, I may just add to that, you know, we really work with the customer because we want to fit the customer's needs a little bit, but we want to make sure, as Darcy's explaining, that we've got the flexibility within the number of hours that we have per year. But each kind of high-density data center can be a little bit different depending upon their operation. You know, with blockchain, they're more tolerable to more hours of interruptions during a year because they'll just simply stop computing or mining for the Bitcoin, the blockchains out there. But some of these data centers also have the more high-density medical imagery or AI type of computing that's going on, and they want less hours per year. So depending upon what the customer may be installing in their data center or hosting for others in their data center, they may have different requirements. So that's why we want to have the flexibility to work with each individual customer.
Okay, so I guess then how do you assure that they aren't driving up your capacity needs?
So part of that, their responsibility, because it does come through what we would have for capacity needs, load, and capability, we would separately calculate what their requirement is and what they get for a benefit and interruption. And anything that they require for their firm service, either we would look to go purchase that, you know, through some other mechanism, a pass-through mechanism. As we talked about, this is a pass-through tariff. So it wouldn't be a direct impact to MDU's other customers. So we could either purchase that capacity from someone else, we could incur it in the auction, or if we had excess, we could sell it at an auction price or something else. But it'd be a pass-through.
And then is some of the interruption, can it be an economic interruption where the prices are just too high? You're going to interrupt them because you don't want to bear the cost of whatever 200 megawatts or 100 megawatts of really high-priced energy? Or how would we be sure that they get that cost?
So part of that is, and again, if it's okay, part of that, if we talk about a pass-through rate, you know, we're looking at one is to have, you know, a separate settlement for this load on a pass-through for their LMPs. So we'd have a separate invoice that we would get from the energy at that location that would be directly passed through to them to pay for. So
okay.
If there's some sort of drive-up.
And that's how this is set up in this tariff?
That's part of the pass-through mechanism we would negotiate in electric service agreement.
Okay, that would be in the ESA.
Correct.
Where is that spelled out here in the tariff rules, that's kind of the design, that it's a pass-through rate?
I think that's part that it's a negotiated rate between us, and that's the pass-through nature that we're looking at.
So you're just saying that's what you guys would include?
Yep.
As kind of your standard approach?
Mm-hmm.
So then whatever the LMP is for their node or their area, that's what they get for their megawatts?
Yes.
Is that hard to keep track of from an accounting standpoint?
No, we think we can actually do that fairly easily. So we can create a separate settlement node, and MISO would settle at that point, with the price at that point.
And we'd be able to track that, our staff?
We would get a separate statement for that, separate from the MD load, is what we're looking at.
So this is a very elementary question. You know, we're bringing up MISO and this type of capacity, and if you have more than one, what role does MISO play in any of this? As far as, do they have any role in whatsoever in these type of agreements and in interruptibles and stuff like that? Nothing?
So there are requirements, Commissioner, if you want to have. So one of the reasons they're interruptible is then you can use that interrupted capacity to meet your resource adequacy requirements plus the planning reserve margin. So it's one of the things that rather than having to build generation for it, they're willing to interrupt if there's a situation where there's a capacity shortage event, similar to we do our contract demand customers.
Right.
Yep, there's that ability. And so in that, as long as you meet the requirements that MISO has in the tariff to qualify for a demand response program, then it's eligible, and they would receive a capacity credit for that load they're willing to interrupt.
MISO would set what they have to have,
yep.
And if they, for whatever
capacity. And is that
capacity.
In the agreement? Is that it all reflected in the agreement?
We would call those out as minimum requirements to make sure we meet those obligations.
Okay.
Just kind of working through an example. So let's just say you had a customer that's 100 megawatts, and they're willing to be 100% interruptible. You would still need to have your capacity at an amount above that, because you only get credit for the 100. You need 112.
You need 12%. The planning reserve margin in the summer is about 7.
Sure.
So 7 megawatts.
Right. So even if they were 100% interruptible, you would still need to have a small amount of incremental capacity.
Correct.
Okay.
Yep.
So how do you cover those capacity costs?
So that would be a pass-through, whatever what we could acquire it at. So separate from the resources we have for our utility customers, we would separately secure that somewhere else. If it's in the auction or if we had access to use in that purpose, we basically would do a sale from ourselves to them.
Okay, and then charge them.
Yep.
So if they want, 20% firm load plus whatever impact they have on the reserve margin requirement, they'd have that included in their in their rate or their ESA. Okay.
I know you have a deposit, and talked about some of that. I didn't see anything. There's no penalties or anything. I mean, you talk about billing and all that, but do you have any penalties built into this? Or a penalty for non-performance, I'm sorry.
So one of the penalties ends up being if you have a demand response event, we call on them or they're called upon by MISO to activate our demand response and they don't participate, that's where there would be a pass-through of that actual penalty cost or avoidance cost for the outage that they didn't take.
Talk a little bit about the terms, too. How did you decide that it should be a minimum of 3 but not to exceed 5?
So part of that is 5 years, from our understanding, is really what the age of the technology is. Mm-hmm. So about every 5 years you're having to turn over if it pretends to be on the chain of blockchain that it ends up being. And the 3 years, we didn't want something to come in for 6 months and leave right away. Sure. There should be some period of time they're willing to stay.
So that deposit would cover that if they did come in for, let's say they said 3 years and they left in a year, some of that deposit would cover that.
So the deposit would really only apply for the non-payment.
Non-payment.
There would be a non-payment.
Right. The upfront covers correct. The, right. Never mind.
Kayak.
Yep.
The what?
Kayak.
The kayak.
Kayak.
Smooth. They can float away, but they've got to leaving their kayak behind.
The one who never remembers an acronym. For some reason, I'm stuck.
I didn't see anywhere in here. It appears that this any potential customer on this rate schedule would not pay any other rate riders. They wouldn't pay renewable generation transmission. Other than the what you had talked about with paying them the MISO schedule portion.
And just one of the unique things about this type of customer, you know, largely they're not going to leverage our system for in terms of like production. So, you know, one of our riders is our generation rider. You know, we're not going to, and Darcy can clean up what I mess up here, but we're not going to dispatch our generation resources for this. I mean, it wouldn't be our intention to. So they're not leveraging our production assets. They're largely not our distribution assets. They are on the transmission, but they're covering that through the transmission, any type of charges. And again, all the marginal costs that these customers are causing, they're going to pay that. So the intention would be they're not really. And wind would be the same. You know, those are generation assets. Theirs is completely separate from all other customers' loads.
Correct. And part of that is that's that pass-through element of all of their energy is just a pass-through from whatever the market is at that time. So there's no benefit they receive from MDU's internal generation.
Sure. So what benefit do they provide to the system then, the rest of the MDU system?
So in that, one of the pass-through charges is they end up being a transmission customer, you know, at the MISO rate for the MDU zone. And so they would pay what our, you know, network transmission service rate is Schedule 9 under the MISO tariff, and that ends up being in this 50-megawatt customer. It would be this $2.4 million they would pay back. In the case of North Dakota, that would get credited back to customers through the transmission rider for North Dakota share.
But when your generation assets are not being fully utilized, then this energy would come from there, wouldn't it?
So part of that, our generation is dispatched economically in the market. So in the case where this would create more load and so we'd be at a higher dispatch in the market, it's really our MDU customers that benefit from that self-generation. There isn't a benefit that this data center load gets from our generation because it's just a pass-through. When our generation runs, if it's in the case of a coal resource or wind, it's whatever our production cost is really what the net customer pays. Because the LMP can be $200, but if we're generating from a $25 coal unit, that's all they're paying in that hour, right? Because our generation is getting paid $200, but the only cost to the customer is 25. And in this case, this customer would not see that benefit. They would just see the whole $200 price when it happened, and there's nothing to offset it for a generation fleet.
Okay. So do you locate these where you have curtailments and they suck up some of that power or not? Is that am I thinking about this totally differently?
It could be a place to do it. You know, the other one typically is if they're paying for all of that upfront cost to hook up, it's kind of important to know what is that cost going to be. So part of that is looking at where can you find available power to connect, and then the other one is there some sort of other benefits maybe they have in their location.
And so like not having to build a big long transmission line or something like that, is correct. That what you're saying? Or
correct, yes.
They're marketing where they have capacity.
Mm-hmm. They're looking for transmission capacity.
Now that I see this again, I don't understand it. Because how do they not drive up the amount of transmission used so then it just increases?
So part of this, what this is showing, is our attachment or formula rate in MISO. It's a formula rate based upon what we have invested in transmission. There's an annual revenue requirement.
Can you just walk through the various lines?
Okay. So the one information on the top is this annual revenue requirement. So for the investment that we have in net book transmission at our O&M and our allocations for G&A plus our return, there's $30.5 million that needs to be collected under that MISO rate in our transmission zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's allocated to loads that are in the zone based upon what their demand is. So today we have two customers, the MDU and the others, that totals up to 600 megawatts. And so that's allocated to each of those customer groups based upon their percentage of load. So if we add more load in the case of the 50 megawatts, that drives down what we're paying, and also there is an additional credit amount that we get back because they're taking service that MISO will credit this back or will give us funds for.
Got it. So your revenue requirement is set. It's just spread over more customers.
More customers that aren't our own.
Yeah.
The historic MDU customers.
So and just across the board, they're all paying a lower per unit.
Sure. Got it.
And because they pay the cost of the connections up front, that X number of dollars that you have to invest does not change your revenue requirement here.
Correct.
The others on here would be folks such as Otter Tail or Basin or someone like that utilizing MDU's transmission.
Correct. It would be the MDU customer load and then the RECs connected on our system.
Okay.
Yep.
So is there a finite number of these that you could add without impacting your capacities or your generators or anything? Help me understand that.
So if it's all in a pass-through, those requirements are separately calculated and secured. So purely from a math standpoint, it's an infinite number. You know, physically you get back to how much is available in the transmission system, depending where they want to connect, that you're not having to build significant facilities that drive away somewhere else.
And so the advantage North Dakota has versus other places in MISO when they're just paying the LMP, because we have lower LMPs here?
The lower LMP would be a benefit of interest. Correct. And I think also the other one is just the ability to site a facility like this. They're probably more easier, readily available here than other places.
Got it.
Isn't cold weather kind of, there's less heating degree days to...
Correct. They can utilize that to minimize other cooling requirements, just the winter conditions.
I always considered that was a big deal to them.
So if the details are a little light as far as the big picture of how this is going to function, it feels kind of like this is going to be a almost like its own little rider, like we would do a transmission or a renewable rider, where there is a certain amount of expenses and there's a certain amount of revenues, and the idea would be for those two net to zero, I think is what I'm hearing from you. Is that...
And I think from a, you know, if I'm thinking along the same lines as you, so for our FCAs or fuel clause adjustments, that's exactly right. We'll separately identify any marginal cost, and then that'll be passed back to this customer and recovered. from that customer.
But there wouldn't be a true up ever of that.
Right. It'll be almost real-time billing, if you will.
Okay. And so what happens if the estimates that were used to determine what those marginal costs were wrong? And if they were wrong in that you were assuming they were higher than they actually are, then MDU just gets a little bit more in revenue and you keep smiling. But if it's less...
I doubt it.
She's going to catch me on that one. Darcy had mentioned on the LMP side, you know, that'll all be identifiable. So that'll be actuals as they're coming in based on real-time and day-ahead LMPs as they occur. On the others, they're all a scheduled rate. So there's a tariffed rate set by MISO or FERC ultimately, mm-hmm. and that's what'll be charged then.
That's the actuals. So whatever that actual billing would be for that time period is another pass-through.
And to differentiate that from our fuel purchase power, you know, we use 4-month rolling average, 1 month delayed,
yep.
and so there is a true up on that. This will be more real time.
Right. I was just trying to get a full picture of all of those different things rolling through, and that helps. The fact that it's not estimates,
yeah.
But it's the actual costs.
Right. And our intention with this would be to almost just isolate these customers. Whether they're big, small, or indifferent, we want to isolate them from, you know, any of our allocation type factors that we do on our plant or equipment, because again, they have very little cost causing on our distribution, production, you know, those type of things. Transmission, we've got that coming through on that which impacts the rider. You know, in terms of sales and even our integrated system. You know, the IRP is essentially for our integrated system. We'll obviously have to do something a little bit to cover these guys, but, you know, we're planning for our integrated system customers all the time. And so our intention would be anything related to these customers would be held separately, if you will.
Okay. How about, like, customer service type of needs for a customer of this size? I mean, would it lead to a, you know, one or a half additional FTE requirement? You know, I mean.
So at this point, we're not envisioning having to add any additional FTEs for this. Would we just be able to just, you know, provide this service with the existing, you know, manpower that we have?
Okay.
So what are the risks that, just summarize the risks and how you've kind of tried to mitigate them. I know you went through it all, but just like the elevator speech.
So I think the one risk is just around their costs, the interconnect, the upgrades that they caused to get the line extension, and certainly they're fully funding that.
Okay. Upfront.
Upfront. Okay. And not non-refundable.
Mm-hmm.
The other one ends up being, you know, there is, you know, certainly the incremental costs that we're going to have to procure energy and services from MISO from. And so those are all at a pass-through. So we're not estimating a rate. We're going to be off in that amount. Whatever it is we're passing it through. Okay. The other part of that is just for non-payment, you know, it's the deposit that Larry talked about that at least covers, you know, any sort of non-payment and cure period before we'd end up being in a default and a termination of service.
And then is there any risk related to the curtailable hours? Like, say they reach the max and need more, then could that impact their, you know, say they only wanted 15 megawatts of firm, but they actually end up needing more than that, then what?
So in part of that is, you know, if they're securing, they're going to have to procure their own capacity resources. That's the pass-through part as well that there's for that. You know, the other one that comes along in curtailments, there probably is some additional language, you know, that we're going to include in a service agreement, which, you know, may differentiate, you know, their responsibilities, you know, during a MISO emergency event. that may be different from our other customers we're kind of envisioning. And so that way there may not be a limitation on those hours, or there may be some other way we're managing those hours if there was an event.
You talked about a service agreement 3 to 5 years in your agreement. Can you end the agreement at any given time?
At this point, we've not contemplated including any sort of early termination. You know, that if we're signing up that 3 to 5 year period, that's when we would offer this rate for that period of time. And again, it's all a pass through, so we're comfortable in doing that.
I was just looking at risk, you
sure.
know, yep. in response to hers. I mean, there's always risk on stuff, and mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm.
And I just want to make sure, because Stephanie kind of gets a star here today on my list of questions, and pretty much just checked them all off as you went through. In fact, I couldn't even make my notes as fast as you were going through them. But to clarify, each ESA will be filed and approved by the commission separately, right? And if someone starts to get in arrears, you've got a deposit to cover that. But, you know, this is where business sometimes gets tough. So now this customer's been rolling along for 2-3 years and everything is going really well, and all of a sudden 1 week or every other week or month or whatever their timing period is, they're a little late, and you call and, you know, we've got the deposit, so you're okay, but we're going to have to cut you off. And, well, you know, it was just an accounting snafu. You know how you always hear it when businesses go bad and things collapse? There was always a series of really good excuses. And so you don't want to cut them off because they've been good. And mm-hmm. is it clear in there exactly how these things will be handled if things start getting just a little bit in arrears?
I believe, commissioners, I believe we will have that spelled out very well in the ESA, and you know, specifying what, you know, the cure period is, and you know, if we have to call on anything, you know, do they need to replenish that, you know, before we continue on, and those types of things. So I think we'll be able to spell that out in each individual ESA.
Because I think it always seems so clear when nothing has happened, but then when it starts to be on the edge is when it gets dicey.
Well, what could go wrong? Everybody understands blockchain.
Yeah.
Cryptocurrency.
And it's, I mean, pretty, it's so easy, too, when it's someone's $100 monthly bill that's a few months already rolled up. But when it's these kinds of numbers, it could make a difference in a hurry. So, and this doesn't really apply so much to what we're doing here, but the big picture perspective, I just am failing to get a grasp of. So, because it's not like just one of these is choosing to do business in North Dakota somewhere and you're a potential supplier. These are popping up all over the place. And around the RTO footprint, around the nation, we're eliminating coal and nuclear. And, you know, 200 hours a year, that's not even 10% of a year. And we know that the wind and solar that we're adding do not produce 90% of the time. They're lucky when they make half. And so it tells me this is causing a whole lot more usage of natural gas around the country for electric generation. If they're going to run all but 200 hours a year, and we're going to set these up all over the place, there's got to be something backing up the wind and solar to power these. And so what does this end up doing to natural gas prices?
So one of the things, Commissioner Crispin, and you know, there certainly is impacts, you know, that increasing load has on where we're at on a dispatch curve. You know, the one thing is we've looked at this is certainly these loads want to locate within the United States, And so it's what are the things we can do to attract and be competitive, because certainly there are benefits to our customers and at least in the tax base, at least in the state. So there are things that we can do to help have this come in. I think one of the things that happens in your situation where you're talking about if the wind and the sun aren't blowing or shining is certainly there's a price signal that may come along with that, where all of a sudden, rather than seeing a $20 L&P, it ends up being $50 and $100. And at least at some point in this pass-through rate, there's a price signal, you know, that blockchain customer is going to have, or this data center customer is going to have, they're going to say, I don't want to purchase energy at this portion of time. So there's a price signal element to this as well, that they have to make a decision. At what point, even though I can operate at this, at what point do I not want to pay for the power economically at this period of time? And they have an ability to make that business decision, which I think in the times of scarcity, it helps them versus saying if we gave them a flat rate, they're just going to want to continue to pay the flat rate no matter what we're having to purchase that power from.
And so do you anticipate that a customer like this would curtail some of their power, maybe keep minimum amounts going when we hit those really high price signals, even if it's more than 200 hours a year?
Well, and if it's so that if they would make that decision economically, that's their own. So it's carved out from the 200 hours. And so I think if they have that ability to see that, you know, they're going to have to make that decision because they're going to see it in their next bill. Do I want to pay this and continue to run my equipment at this time, or do I want to make another decision and, you know, and to shut that down, forego it for this period of time?
So when we look at the heat map and look at the LMPs, if it's $150, that's what they're paying.
It would be. Well, there's a day ahead and a real time again. So when you end up seeing the heat maps, you're always seeing what's the real-time price. Yeah. So if and again, from a standpoint of securing that power, if they put it all in the day ahead, that's the price that they're going to clear at.
Because I'm sure MISO is the same, but I know in SPP, the amount, and I don't know what we consider anymore really high price times, but the amounts of what I consider to be really high price times are rising dramatically year to year, and I'm sure it's the same in MISO.
Mm-hmm. You know, Randy, you bring up some good points, and it's interesting from sitting in this seat, we always hear from, you know, requesting this type of service where I, as an individual, have never heard from the individual companies saying what they're willing to do. It's based on more of a need, you know, we want this, North Dakota's a good location, 24/7, you know, and all that, but we don't hear from them that they're willing to be that interruptible. So, I mean, I know you can't speak on behalf of them. I'm just saying that's, for me, that's a real interesting point that I've never had an opportunity to talk to some of them.
Well, they would be available if there's an ESA, then that kind of a conversation could occur because we approve each one of those, right? I'm assuming that.
Right.
We did approve one before you came here. We did get to, not for for these guys, but Otter Tail. And the company came to the discussion about their ESA.
Discussion point.
I'm good on this one.
To Randy's question on the, just to confirm, Darcy, you said if they're making the economic decision to curtail, that doesn't count to the 200 hours.
That's correct.
Okay. All right, Randy's good. Do you have any more, Sherry? Any more questions?
Not at this time.
Well, there may not be another time. So.
I am Victor.
Okay. You can always ask these guys.
I think I'm good. We worked through a lot of the concerns that I had as I reviewed the application. I mean, a lot of it's going to come down to making sure we have a lot of our concerns covered in the specific ESAs as they come in. Because the others, the difference in this versus the other ones we've seen. So Otter Tail's had the one tariff like this in place for a number of years, and it's a little bit more specific in how it works and how it's calculated versus this one. But this is a different way of looking at it that on the surface seems to work, and we just have to work through the details of each ESA as they come in.
What is Otter Tail's? Does that start at 10 megawatts too, or you recall?
25 megawatts.
It almost seems like that is something. Should they be all over the place, or should there be some consistency on where things like the minimum curtailable hours or the amount that it takes to qualify? Should there be consistency?
I don't know.
It's a question, not a proposal. But
it may be more utility specific based on the utility's abilities and system.
Good point.
So the framework seems appropriate. Seems like you've covered a lot of the big risks, and we still have a lot of flexibility to review the ESAs, and if we're concerned, those can be addressed there. Okay. I don't have any more questions either. So, anybody in the room? Okay, I think there's something else I have to say here. Let's see. So is there any evidence to the information you guys provided and the filings being used as the material for us to make a decision? Company? Allison?
No objection from staff.
Okay.
No objection.
All right, then that will be come part of the formal record on which a decision is made. I don't think anybody has anything more to add, do we? All right. Then this informal on case number PU-22-337 is closed. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Are we doing anything with this?
That was just information.